It. Welcome to another episode of Drawing Blood, our podcast about histories of science and medicine, art and art history, and the macabre. I'm Christy Slobogan.
And I'm Emma Merkling, and I'm really excited that we're back.
Yes, so excited that we're back. We took a brief pause, so thank you everybody for being so patient. And while we were ostensibly pausing so that Emma could rest and recover, she was actually working on this incredible project, which is what this episode stems, pun intended,
oh my God,
out of.
There's a lot of this.
There's actually a lot of plant puns.
There could be more.
We
like to rein things in at Drawing Blood.
That's usually how I describe myself, really reined in. Yeah.
Demure, I would say.
That's me.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, very briefly, the project was looking at the Victorian idyll, IDYLL, which you don't need to know that much about. But yeah, it's a book I co-edited with my colleague Thomas Hughes, Rethinking the Victorian Idyll in Victorian Art and Literature, and especially attending to its darker edge, its politics. We talk a lot about race and colonialism, queerness, and a lot about ecology. And there's some really great chapters also about, you know, how the manufacture of idylls created like real world environmental effects through deforestation and stuff. But my chapter is about Julia Margaret Cameron's photograph, Maud.
Which, you know, if you've listened to other Drawing Blood episodes, one of us always brings in an object, an idea, or an image to start us off with. And so Emma brought in Julia Margaret Cameron's Maud. And then from that starting point, which is such a fascinating image, and I'm so glad and grateful that I got a chance to look at it more closely. But so we really use it to think about plant-human entanglements, primarily in the Victorian era, while also taking some detours around a lot of history of science, history of ecology in that era, but thinking about the colonial body and plant entanglements, killer plants, plant carnivory, Darwin, femme fatales, dangerous plant, queer plants, othered bodies via ecology. There's a lot going on here and it's all really, really exciting. And yeah.
Okay, Christy, so let me pull up the picture for you. So I've been thinking about this photograph since 2018 when I first presented about it at a symposium. You know, I'm very much a novice to this area that's called like critical plant studies, but a lot of the themes that I think surround this picture, this photograph, are things I've been thinking about for a long time, and I've never enjoyed writing anything as much as I enjoyed this. So the photograph is Julia Margaret Cameron's Maud from 1874 or 1875, and a poem that accompanies it. So,
right. So I love hearing that this is the piece that you've loved writing the most. Okay. So I'm really, really excited to hear what you have kind of uncovered about this photograph and about the work, because I feel like, and no shade, but this is the kind of Victorian photograph that you kind of look at and you're like, okay, sweet, and move on. Right? It's got like the kind of wilting woman against a nice backdrop, you know, that kind of fuzzy sepia tone that Julia Margaret Cameron is quite well known for, that kind of soft focus, right? And so what we've got here is on, and we'll obviously, as usual, link to all of the images on our website and in our show notes. So we're using the piece from the Getty collection. So it's not only a photograph, but it's also the blue paper and writing that it's backed onto. In the photograph itself, on the right side, we've got a young white woman leaning against a brick wall, and she's in a white billowy top or dress, very Grecian. And kind of adding to the Grecian element is kind of these plants that are encircling her and that are crawling up the brick wall behind her. Because it almost, like, you've got leaves around her head that almost allude to like a laurel crown, also Grecian. And then, you know, you've got her very like straight aquiline nose in profile that also adds to that feel of the Grecian. But anyway, so that's her. And then the plants, I would say, take up actually the majority of the image. And they are covering this brick wall again. And the plants themselves, I don't know what these are called, but they're quite, and I have a feeling because this is the podcast that it is, that we will get onto the spooky, but they are quite spooky and like pokey flowers. I don't know what they are. I'm sure you know, but I think I've seen them in real life a couple of times and they're like bright purple.
Yes. If you've lived in if you'd actually lived in the UK, no, I'm joking.
How rude.
it's a passion flower or passion fruit flower. In South Africa, we have ones where you can actually eat the fruit. Like they actually produce, we call it granadilla, but can you tell why there's a passion flower plant?
Yeah. So I didn't know that. And so that obviously, you know, the word passion relating to like lust, eroticism, love kind of changes maybe the tone of the photograph a bit. I don't know. But I think it's also interesting relating to what flower it is. And also it's just what sticks out to me the most, the more that I look at this photograph, is that one of the tendrils or one of the vines of this plant is kind of crawling up her Grecian outfit, like up across her shoulder, almost like a sash, but it's almost like it's drawing her in, like the passion flower is drawing her into this brick wall. So that's definitely what kind of is the most interesting point of this photograph to me.
And what would you say like the affective range of the photo is? Like when you look at it, what's sort of the emotional range that's being conveyed?
That's a really good question. Because like I said at the beginning, like I think if you just look at this photograph for 2 seconds, you're like, oh, quite a calm, like peaceful Victorian photograph. Cool. Move on. But then like her, I don't know, there's almost like a resignation to it. There's a hint of melancholy. And then there's that underlying like simmering unease, I think, in like her, what her relation is to these plants. And, you know, is she fading into them, into this brick wall? Is she like resigned to what's happening to her? Or is this just something that's like innocent and peaceful as it first appears?
And I think that Cameron draws out some of those properties. So if you zoom in, I mean, the quality of this photograph that's on the Getty website is incredible. You can zoom all the way in and there's places where plant and person shade into each other. So like in the nape of her neck, and that's because of Cameron's, as you mentioned, she's really famous for these soft focus effects. So we'll definitely get back to the atmosphere of the photo, which I also think is quite sensuous. And, you know, one of the things that got me interested in the first place was, I think absolutely, as you say, it's a photo that really rewards close looking. And the more you look, the more sort of reveals itself to you. In real life, it's very large as photographs go. But yeah, so there's, and then the affective range for me is the sensuousness that's tinged with melancholy. You know, she's like the stare into the middle distance, you know, the sensuousness created, yes, by that passion flower that's pulling close to her and like caressing her head, the sort of way her hair's swept back off the ear. Almost, is she lying in bed? Like what position? Are we looking down at her?
You know, that's a really good point. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Head on.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's never, it's sort of oscillating between these two poles, I would say.
And I think, you know, using that word caress is really good because I think that sensuousness comes from like the touch of the plant onto her, like the way that it's flowing over her, the way that it's kind of hugging her close to the wall. It does feel like a very tactile interaction between her and this passion flower, whatever we're calling it.
Sort of just to underscore the point, what you're talking about is, you know, that vine is pressing so close to her. It's pressing so tight to her body that it actually sinks into the folds of the fabric.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that at first. Yeah, but you miss part of the vine because the fabric is being pulled in a way that it's kind of overlapping it because the vine is so tight around her.
And it's funny also you brought up the Grecian thing because there's also a way in which to me, Maud, who's the subject of the photo, we'll get to that in a second, is sort of hovering between being a flesh and blood woman, which of course is what the camera is insisting on. You know, this is a flesh and blood woman who was photographed, and some sort of marble, maybe a Venus, you know, because.
Yeah, and I can so definitely see that, that.
By that token, that press, the press of the plant into the flesh is almost like those Bernini.
Yes. Sketches, yes. You know? Very much like the Bernini sculptures, which we will definitely link to as well, where he, you know, would sculpt marble so deftly that you could almost see the touch of fingerprints upon like thighs and how they pressed into skin. And I definitely see an echo of that here.
And, you know, he was also with Apollo and Daphne, or the rape of Daphne, or...
I'm pretty sure it's the Daphne one.
Yeah, but she's actually, she's transforming into, she's leaping away from him and transforming into a tree. I kept thinking of that sculpture, actually, when I was thinking about this picture, partly because the shape of that vine across her chest and the way that her hair curls behind her ear creates, do you see this like dynamic spiral in the composition that reminds me a bit of the bodies turning away in the Bernini?
Yeah, I can see that.
And if you follow the spiral, it's really interesting. It almost guides your eye through the composition. So you have those, that sort of like pert little pair of passion flowers at the left. Then it sweeps down, guided by the vine, and then up across her chest, up along the top of her head. And then either it sweeps back down to point towards the passion flowers, or it sweeps back sort of up along the neck of her gown and into her face. Like, there's this mobility, I think. There's a like a vitality to the photograph that's sitting a bit in contrast to the marble stillness of Maud.
Absolutely. And once again, emphasizing how this is a photograph that needs close looking. You do not, if you don't follow that spiral and like actually spend some time with it, it feels like a very still image. She's just leaning against a brick wall. Cool. But as you say, if you actually let the photograph take you along with it, you get a lot more motion. Yeah, it's quite an affecting image, I think.
I think so. And we'll get back to, I think a lot, you've touched on a lot of themes that I think are really interesting that we'll come back to. But I just want to give you a bit of background to the photograph, because you're also not meant to see it in isolation from the poem that, as we mentioned, accompanied it. So I want us to look at the poem as well and just see how that maybe alters, maybe reiterates, you know, some of the ways we were looking at this photograph. I also want to take issue with you saying this is like any other Victorian photograph, which made me whistle. But we'll come back to that. We'll come back to how it's different.
I'm sorry. But that's also me. Like, this is outside of my realm of, like, you know, I work on medical photographs, wildly different. And so, you know, in order to survive in the world of art history, you end up putting things in buckets of like, ah, that's what that usually looks like. So to me, a Julia Margaret Cameron, I'm like, oh, that's, you know, that era of photography. Anyway, but totally fair. You're allowed to bristle.
So Cameron was like a lady amateur, is how she's often called. She was gifted a camera quite late in life. I think she was in her 50s. I have to double check, maybe her 40s. She was very much involved in process. And I think photographic process and her process is something that we're going to talk about. But part of this is she produced these really big photographs and preferred this large format. It allowed the effects that she was playing with to be more visible. It's, you know, turned it, as you were sort of saying in a way, Christy, into an object of attention, like a painting on a wall, right? It's not just something to be sort of flipped past in haste. It's something to spend time with.
And yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And Maud. So Maud is the final photograph in a 2-volume photo book that Cameron made. And the story goes that Alfred Tennyson, who was, of course, the Victorian poet laureate and one of the most famous figures of the 19th century, and very, very close friends with Cameron. They lived sort of side by side in Freshwater on the Isle of Wight. He invited her to illustrate a new People's Edition for his set of Arthurian poems, The Idylls of the King. And Cameron agreed and sort of really enthusiastically set about taking what she claimed to be almost 250 exposures of friends, family, loved ones, people who lived on the Isle of Wight, anyone she could corral into posing as these Arthurian figures. So there's Merlin and Vivian, you know, there's Guinevere. She really, you know, she covers a lot of the legends. What ended up happening was the publishers converted her photographs into tiny woodblock engravings. And she hated what this did because it compressed them into a tiny format and then made them really crisp. Because, you know, I mean, a matte picture woodblock, you know?
Yeah, of course.
Like sharp black and white. Okay. And so then what she decided to do was she was like, okay, I'm going to self-publish this photo book. And Maud came from the second volume, which was the other poems section. So it's not actually an Idyll of the King. It takes its subject from another Tennyson poem. And Cameron's habit in this photo book was to excerpt the relevant part of Tennyson's poem, handwrite it, and then lithograph it into the photo book on the page, sort of on the overleaf of the photograph. So if you scroll to the side on this Getty link, move your cursor at the bottom all the way to the side.
Okay.
Can you see the poem?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I see. Okay. I did not even notice that there were other images. I understand how it's set up in this photo book now. I was just looking at the standalone photograph. That makes a lot more sense. Also, going back to woodblocks, looking at this photograph, it feels like there are no pure blacks or whites. So I can see why putting it into that printing method would really mess with her vision of this. Okay. So if we're looking at the poem page that accompanies this photograph, it says in Julia Margaret Cameron's handwriting, "There has fallen a splendid tear from the passion flower at the gate. She is coming, my dove, my dear. She is coming, my life, my fate. The red rose cries, she is near, she is near. And the white rose weeps, she is late. The larkspur listens, I hear, and the lily whispers, I wait. She is coming, my own, my sweet, were it ever so airy a tread. My heart would hear her and beat, were it earth in an earthy bed. My dust would hear her and beat, had I lain for a century dead, would start and tremble under her feet and blossom in purple and red." So there we go. Passion flower. See, if I'd looked at the poem, I would have, that would have made sense.
Or even if the caption handwritten under the photograph on that blue paper.
Oh my God. Does it also say passion flower?
Yeah. It's titled the passion flower at the gate.
Oh yeah. I see that now. I'm just, you know, for an art historian, obviously very observant, but I don't think I even knew. I wasn't looking for passion. Anyway. Okay.
Yeah, no,
beautiful poem. I
so the poem is excerpted from Tennyson's poem Maud, and the snippet that Cameron has chosen to excerpt and then photographically illustrate comes from the sort of epicenter of the poem. Forgetting the photograph for a second and just thinking about the poem, you have the narrator who is waiting in this garden for Maud. It comes from the most famous part of the poem, which starts, "Come into the garden, Maud," you know, and he's come into her garden. He thinks she has sent him a message via a rose and he's waiting for her. And you can almost hear this anticipation in the meter and the rhythm of the poem. And it almost builds up as the poem goes. So you have, you know, the sort of, "She's coming, my life, my fate. She is near, she is near. She is late. I hear, I wait." But then you have this sort of, "My sweet tread, beat, bed, beat, dead," sort of rhythm.
Right.
And it's like a heart pounding. Like,
yeah, 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 yeah. Or footsteps or something, like something pushing forward.
Exactly. So,
okay. We didn't say who Maud actually was.
So you don't have to know the whole story of Tennyson's poem, Maud, but Maud is the beloved. She is, you know, when the narrator says, "Come into the garden, Maud," Maud is who he is speaking to. And you don't have to know sort of the whole story, but basically it's sort of, Tennyson called it his little Hamlet. So Maud is sort of the Ophelia. And it's about this narrator. It's a very bleak poem, actually. It starts with this gory description of his father's body mangled and flattened and dinted. That's a quote, into the ground.
Oh my God.
In this like bloody, dripping, exposed rib. It's pure horror. It's a love poem in many ways, but it opens with the words, "I hate."
Okay.
And basically it's about this narrator's inherited madness and how his love for Maud, who's this girl who he's sort of known since childhood and who lives nearby, but then he sort of becomes attached to again, almost brings him out, is this almost, what's the word I'm looking for? Like vitalizing, redemptive love.
Rejuvenating.
And one of the things that's interesting is that as Maud emerges in the poem, there's this feeling of resurrection. So from this opening scene of like death and horror, Maud is always accompanied by the other than human world coming alive.
So like a resurrection in a garden, like it's like she's
exactly
almost like blooming after a long winter or something, like she's that figure.
And then there's this confusion, right, where it's like she makes him bloom, she is blooming, you know. If you look at the poem at the end here, there's this grave imagery, right, this resurrection imagery. He sort of says, you know, the poem at this point almost collapses into the endlessness of like Sleeping Beauty. Like he's been waiting so long that he's almost in this like death-like slumber, you know, his earth in an earthy bed. Had I lain for a century dead.
Right. There's also something in that last line, in blossom and purple and red. I mean, I feel like in a lot of kind of melodramatic stories of, you know, of violence. You hear a lot about like red blooms, you know, when someone is struck by a gunshot or a, or, you know, or is wounded in some way, like red blooms across their body or across their clothing. Ugh. And so blossom and purple and red kind of gives me that kind of bruising, bloody language
in
a way.
You're so on the money. One of the reasons I'm obsessed with this photograph is I think that there is this holding together of like death and life, of hate and love, of, you know, I don't want to spoil too much. I want us to get there together, you know,
right.
But one of the ways that we are sort of cued as readers who would have read this poem, right? Who would come to, I mean, Tennyson was super famous and this poem is very famous. You would come to the photo knowing parts of the poem. It both opens and closes with blood, blood red, but more specifically, it closes with this, he goes anyway. So basically the plot is, you know, he falls in love with Maud. There's this central episode where he waits in the garden, but when she arrives, she's like followed hot on her heels as her brother, and the narrator and the brother duel. He kills the brother. There's this awful.
And blood blooms.
Yeah.
Blood blooms across a billowing white shirt or something. That's how I always picture a duel, right?
Totally. And there's this shrill cry for brother's blood. He says that will echo in my ears till I die, till I die, till I die. Like, and
wait,
so
does the brother die or the lover?
The brother. So the narrator then like flees. He gets plunged back into sort of madness and misery and despair. And sidebar that we don't have time to get into in this episode, there's a lot about how Tennyson based his, how he figured this voice on contemporary definitions of insanity. Because it's a very, like it's the voices of the narrator are very fractured. They sort of shift and change. There's no stable, despite it being a lyrical poem, there's no stable lyric. You know, the meter is always shaking up. And then the poem closes on him finding some sort of slightly empty form of redemption when he goes off to fight in the Crimean War. And
okay.
And it closes with the blood red blossom of war.
Blood red blossom. There
exactly.
We go. Okay. So,
you're buying the money.
Also interesting that the Crimean War is thought of as like the place where medical and war photography really took off.
Yeah.
So thinking about like the history of 19th century photography and this image, that's an interesting place for this poem to end and to be illustrated by a photograph.
Yes. And I guess like when we look back at the photograph, there's this dual context going on that I'm really interested in. And I'm curious if for you, as it did for me, it changed how I felt about the photograph, because, you know, on the one hand, there's this excerpt that Cameron has sort of plucked like a flower from the heart of the poem. That's very idyllic. You know, you have this sensorium and like building up to this point in the poem, you know, there's this like the wafting scent of the, like the larkspur and the musk. And it's like you have this vitalized world by, as I was saying, you know, at the beginning, the world, Maud is sort of ghostly and his world is sort of dead and murdered and mangled. And by the, this point in the poem, the whole world is vitalized. Even the earth is trembling and beating.
I think in terms of your question of how that knowing more about the poem changes the image for me, I think for me, what it really is that kind of cold language of the grave, like the dead earth, and then the thinking about the brick wall as well, and kind of what you were saying earlier about like, is she laying down? Like it kind of has, it brings out the melancholy and the kind of simmering unease a bit more when you're thinking about blooming purple and red blood, when you're thinking about the grave, when you're thinking about like resurrection. And it's like, okay, has she come out of this cold earth, this cold wall, that kind of thing? Or
you mean is she real or a ghost?
Yeah. And like, what world does she belong to? Does she belong to the cold, unfeeling world of the grave and therefore the brick wall behind her? Or does she belong to like the vital blooming purple and green and red, like world of the plants that are encircling her?
And I think that Cameron's answer is both. And
yeah,
this is the thing that I find so fascinating about her, and I'm sure we'll get to, is so Cameron had this firm belief that she frequently cited where she sort of said what she, her ambition for photography was to make sort of people see that it was an art form where the real and ideal could combine. And because there was this, she's basing it off this understanding of a discourse in the 19th century of a separation of the two. We've discussed in the pod before, you know, scientific photography, that crisp forensic detail, photography's claims to realism, to truth claims, and then fine art, by contrast, especially symbolist art, especially art that is like illustrating poetry, that is trying to evoke emotion, that's evoking, you know, sensuousness, that those two things are diametrically opposed.
And I think it's really interesting just in terms of like the history of scientific photography and like photography and ecology or even botany. You know, we're looking at flowers here. And by, you know, Juliet Margaret Cameron saying, okay, I'm using photography as an art here, like showing that it isn't this thing that's totally without artfulness, without human interference. And in the 19th century, you know, botanists, or historically, botanists and amateur ecologists, which was like a field that was growing in this era, were like really did not trust photographers to illustrate their scientific material because they thought that it wasn't artful enough to capture like the details of the plants, the flowers that they were looking at. And so they, much longer than a lot of other scientific disciplines, you know, relied on illustrators, which, so I think it's this interesting kind of overlapping between artfulness and precision in photography here, and like a kind of turning it on its head when it, especially when flowers and these kinds of like botanical subjects are at the forefront.
Absolutely. And also this question, you know, that I hadn't really thought about, but that you've made me think about, this question of, you know, if you zoom in, because I told you it's really high quality, on those passion flowers, they are captured with this crisp forensic detail. And I think one of the things that Cameron's photograph asks of us, you know, in straddling sort of these realms between the material and the spiritual, the real and the ideal, is what is the more accurate representation of the ecological microcosm, right? Is it this plant entangled sort of relationally with other beings and its environment? You know, in this case, a person, you know, or is it that sort of botanical drawing, which, yeah, could show the object sort of in situ, but was very stylized, was, you know, I mean, you know more about this than I do, but, or often, you know, specimens, like the removing of something from its environment, and how these specimens that ended up at Kew at this time were all sort of dried and like misshapen and the wrong color.
Right.
Like, which is the better representation, the artful one or the forensic one, I guess, is, it's the same question from a slightly different angle.
No, absolutely. And I think you put that better than I did, but I think it's interesting to know that kind of, I think that question is really interesting in terms of like the longer history of botanical illustration. And I think Cameron's photograph shows like, okay, this is actually how we can understand. Of course, you don't get color, but like, what does that actually matter if you can see it in situ and how it's growing and how it interacts with its environment?
Okay, well, so we've talked about plants, and I really want to get, I want to hear you on plants in Maud, because I think also the poem, where did you notice we have plants speaking in direct voice? Like there's literally quote marks around what they're saying, the lily, the rose.
And it immediately, which I know is around the same period, immediately takes me to Lewis Carroll and the white and red roses, the garden in Alice in Wonderland, all of those kind of like anthropomorphized things and plants and beings. It very that.
Because the Victorian world is yay big, like, Cameron actually photographed Alice Little as well in this sort of plant sensuous entanglement. Did you know this at the same time?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I did know that. That is one thing that I did know about Victorian photography is that Alice was photographed by both of them. Yeah. Little and the Idyll. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Christ. Anyway.
I know. I'm sorry. My brain just makes the stupidest connections.
I've missed this. This is what I was missing in my chapter. but I want to hear what you think about plants in this, but I think just for those who aren't as familiar with the 19th century, it's worth just briefly saying that this is a period, I mean, this is now, it's such a commonplace to even like point this out, but it's like, it's a period, especially the first half of the 19th century, where British people are being put into relation with plants and being made aware of plants so much more. You know, so you have like the founding, I mean, you have a bunch of like gardeners publications being made for like a popular audience, and like this rise in horticulture as both like a science and an art. Also fascinating gendered stuff about the rise of women botanists.
And I mean, a lot of that rise in botany and horticulture stemmed from the empire and like bringing those plants back from other places that Britain had.
Absolutely. You know, and from the extraction, practices of extraction, right? Like
absolutely.
That merge onto colonial practices.
And just tying back to our last episode of our first season on like museums and collection, a lot of the folks, the men who, and Claire Hickman's book, The Doctor's Garden, is great on this. But a lot of the men who were like these famous imperial botanists who were bringing back plants and animals and like, you know, being quote unquote serious scientists, their practice of collecting these objects also led them to collect other objects, which led to the founding of a lot of the museums in London. Like, so these things are, you know, if we think about plants as not part of visual culture, they're directly related in terms of like practices of collecting, practices of colonialism, and like the founding of museums.
Yeah, not kind just visual aside, culture, but material, political, medical, like, you know, it's bodily.
Yeah. And thinking of plants as pieces of material culture is not a way, that's not like the first way of thinking about them, but I think we need to think about them in that way. They're things to be, that are often extracted, collected in the same way as a lot of other objects were and are.
And people. And I think that one, yes, of that sort of segues into what I wanted to talk about, which was plant agency and what is shifting in the period around which Cameron is taking this photograph. But maybe I've dangled a little carrot. Maybe you can get there with the photograph and the poem.
Well, I will say that I read one thing by the brilliant Lindsay Wells, which I'm sure that we'll get to, but she called it vegetal agency, which I just sounds so sexy in a way. I'm like, yes, vegetal agency, like let's go.
Absolutely.
So the way that I see that playing out in this image, and I do think, so a lot of the things that I know about plants in this period is about houseplants. And that's why I brought up colonialism too, because those things are very intertwined. But I think it's interesting that, so from where I know more things about houseplants, this is so clearly outside. And so yes, it's like she is in the realm of the vegetation, right? Like she is not in a home cultivating the vegetation. It is almost in a way cultivating her. So that's where we get the vegetal agency in this image. And I think the vegetal agency really appears in that vine across her shoulder. Like we said in the initial visual analysis, like bringing, almost pulling her towards the wall. And it's also in the fact that the vegetation is what causes the movement in this image. That's what creates the spiral that you were talking about. It's what activates this kind of stayed, potentially marble, like potentially immobile or dead figure, like at the center of what is, you know, people are usually the center of these kinds of compositions. But in reality, if you take a time to look at it, it's the agency of the vegetation that really is.
And as you said, she's pushed off center. Like the plant is,
yes,
who is the subject? Who is the subject in this work, really?
Yeah.
You know,
no, it feels like,
who is the subject of and in the photograph?
Yes. And it's almost like, okay, this may be reading too much into it, but when is it ever reading too much into it? It's not. but it's almost like, you know, usually if you're thinking about portrait photographs, you usually can see both of the eyes and you're kind of like head, yes, on to the face if it's truly a portrait of someone, right? And I love that here you've only got the one eye in profile view of the actual human being here, but those two passion flowers next to each other almost serve as like a stand-in for a face. And then you've got almost like an arm reaching across the figure. Yes. And it's so like you can see, well, it's like that, whatever it's called, where human beings automatically read faces into things. And so the more I'm looking at it, this, I'm like, okay, there are two eyes, and then you've got a vine underneath that kind of reads as like a slash of a mouth. And then you've got maybe the vertical bit of the grouting of the bricks as a nose in between. And then, like I said, the arm sweeping around.
Except, and I think this is important, because I think that the plant resists being read that way, even as, you know, you try to see those two things as eyes. Okay, but then what's the third passion flower above it?
No,
okay,
for
maybe
sure.
Maybe then that's a head, and then they are breasts. And then is that
okay,
an arm?
Yeah.
Or is it like a phallic tendril? But I think that I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying it's both and. It's once using humanized idea, you know, like using the human to give us that sense of agency that we're not used to looking for in a plant, and resisting being read as anything other than it is, which is this spread, this vegetal mass, this mesh that she's being drawn into.
I totally buy that. It's both and. Yeah. But I like, you know, this conversation of agency pushes you to see those things. And I think that's a really helpful way of thinking about it.
And to underscore, by the way, that we're not overreading this, the poem is all about vegetal agency. The plants are the ones who are speaking. In fact, one of the things that's fascinating about this photo, and is one of the things that got me thinking there was a chapter in this to begin with, was where is the narrator in this photograph or in the excerpted poem? You don't have a narrator. You have a dispersal of plant agent narrators, plant narrators, all sort of jointly. I'm almost thinking of mushrooms, like jointly expressing desire. Like they want more to be there. They can't wait for her to be there. She's coming, you know, and they're going to blossom when they're going to, you know,
they're
going to
blow their spores. They're so excited.
I was trying to think of a way to say it.
You were going to say it, but you didn't. So I did.
What the listener can't see is me doing big sploosh hand gestures while I was talking. No, go on.
I don't know if we'll get to Anna Atkins at any point, but I did just want to bring up, like, in terms of vegetal agency, and Anna Atkins was a photographer who published her cyanotypes, which are like beautiful blue photographs that are done by placing
an object on photosensitive paper and then exposing it to sunlight.
Yeah, exactly. So it's it seems like a more simple process, I guess, than what we're used to photography being. But she published it before William Henry Fox Talbot. Yeah, he's got like a million names, but before Talbot's big book, right? And anyway, I read this article that argued that Anna Atkins' photographs are a truly collaborative plant-human process. Like, it's a process of co-creating because it's very direct, and she is working with the plants to create these images, which is such an interesting pairing to have. You know, Anna Atkins, another, you know, woman photographer, pioneering woman photographer, her plant images of, I believe her book was on British sea algae, right? In comparison with Julia Margaret Cameron's pioneering, very different, but kind of also, I would argue, collaborative, if not co-creating with the plant, but kind of a collaborative process with the natural world. So it's interesting to have those two kind of in conversation.
And well, let's get into it. I mean, visually, there is something of Anna Atkins in this photograph, and it's in those highly stylized black on white, or, you know, I know hers were blue and white, but, you know, high contrast relief, you know, it's like, it looks like it's an object that, you know, has a lot of detail, but through its juxtaposition with a brighter form takes on a flatness that is very visually reminiscent of her images.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with that. And I hadn't thought of that as like a direct visual echo with Anna Atkins.
And I haven't read that article, but I think, spoiler, that this photograph is about, in many ways, a joint summoning. And it was actually, I was going to offer a slight corrective to something you said earlier, where you said, you know, it's not the house plant brought into the house, but, you know, she's in this vegetal realm. It's actually a realm that's not a co-creation, but it's a brick wall, which is human, tangled and choked and covered by vines, overtaken.
You're totally right. Yeah, it's much more collaborative. Yeah, you're totally right.
The other way in which this is, that Anna Atkins is often on my mind when I'm working on Cameron, is that one of the things Cameron did that stood her apart from other photographers is, it was professional photographic custom to efface any of the many blemishes and errors that occurred during the photographic process. And Cameron would deliberately retain them. And she said, she explicitly linked it to art. She said, once again, I'm going to try to remember this quote offhand, but something like, I'm the only photographer who keeps my spots. And it is for this reason that artists value my work. And so there's this fascinating Carol Armstrong, my forever fave, who has written, I think, consistently some of the best stuff on Julia Margaret Cameron, talks a lot about how the fascinating and marvelous thing about her art is that, you know, that is where the real inheres, in these indexical traces, meaning the touching of the plates. And often you get actual fingerprints and smudges on her thing. In Maud, there's a spot, a black spot on her sleeve. There's a couple of cracks,
oh, yeah, I see,
or
that
maybe
now.
Hairs. Yeah. So there's also this biological matter that is touching the plate, and Cameron's marks as the photographer are touching the plate. And it's this joint thing of like, this photograph is real, not because it offers the illusion of realism, like an unmediated vision of reality, but because I am real, I touched it, I made it, it's a real object. Here's proof that I was physically here. And that for me, Anna Atkins, are indexes, right? They're direct, the plant touching the paper.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, we've been talking about plant agency stuff and about overreading, but I want to say that this photograph, this is not the first time Cameron photographed Maud, but this photograph is very different from her earlier iterations, which she did in the 60s. And how they're different is they don't show this tangle, you know, this involvement, this sort of, you know, is Maud leaning in desirously? Is she being sucked in? Like, we don't know what the nature of the entanglement is, but you can't deny that there is an entanglement. And also, it's hard to imagine that Maud could have gotten herself so entangled with the plant without its action.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that.
So if we ask ourselves, like, what had changed by 1874, I mean, I think on the one hand, sort of the rise of the idyllic mode, which is one of the things my book sketches out, which is sort of articulating new ways of sort of humans in quote unquote nature, or, you know, the other than human world, sort of a formal language for grappling with some of these effects. But also Cameron's friendship with Darwin and Darwin's writing. Yeah. And Darwin's writings on mobile and willful plants.
Oh, well, she did. So I was like, oh, that's a surprise. But she did photograph Darwin, right? Mm-hmm. She's done a portrait of him. She has done. She did do a portrait of him.
Yeah. So in that portrait was taken in 1868 when the Darwin family visited Cameron and Tennyson on the Isle of Wight. And so, okay, plants had always been really important to Darwin's theory. Several years before this, he'd published On the Origin of Species, you know, which was, of course, his big hit, his most famous book. And in 1871, The Descent of Man. Those are the two that we tend to remember. But in between, he was writing a lot about plants. And his special fascination was climbing plants, which includes the passion flower. And he ends up sort of in this period around which he's meeting Cameron, and then before she takes his photo, and then a little bit after, he's publishing a lot on plants. Like, there's this burst in his output. And his program really is, in his own words, to elevate plants in the scale of being so that their difference from animals is not seen as so distinct.
I can definitely see an elevation of plants in terms of like giving them more agency in this photograph. Oh, that's totally convincing. Yeah.
Yeah. And his special fascination is tendrils. And so Darwin spent hours, like, he used like a glass sort of bell jar and a piece of paper around it. And as he would map every hour, he would come to the climbing plant and map where its tendrils were. And it created these beautiful spiral diagrams. I will try find you one. It's worth it.
And spiral, like the composition of the photograph. Yeah,
exactly.
Love it.
It's a diagram of a spiral.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Okay. So he was trying to argue for vegetal agency, as I said earlier, right?
Yeah. Or I guess his study of plants had led him to this position that they were in fact a lot more mobile and a lot more sensitive than we had previously given them credit for. And that collapsed in his own writing, as sort of contemporaries recognized, and in later interpretations of Darwin, artistic, fictional, etc. This collapsed them onto something approaching sentience. And there's this fantastic letter to his son where he says, "My current hobby horse is at present tendrils. They are so crafty and willful and sagacious." Wait, Ooh. Is that how you pronounce that? But yes, you know, sagacious? Like that they have sagacious?
Sagacious? But, I don't know.
But these crafty, willful, and wise. And he talks about how they pursue things, quote, in manifest relation to their wants, not their needs.
Okay. This is making me think of, I mentioned that Lindsay Wells article, this idea of crafty and willful plants. I absolutely love, because in the Victorian period, as argued or as shown by Lindsay Wells in her article, Vegetal Bedfellows, there was this myth of the dangerous houseplant. So, you know, again, this is people bringing the plant world into their home, right? But there was this myth that you couldn't have houseplants in your bedroom because of their ability, their agency, their ability to photosynthesize and respire.
Bro, like, my mom won't let me sleep in a room with too many plants because she's like, they will choke you and you will die.
Yeah. So the idea, like there were in Victorian periodicals, there were these articles about, you know, these women being suffocated because it was believed, I mean, it's true in a very small amount, but it was believed that at night plants released a lot of carbon dioxide. So it would suffocate the people in their bedrooms. Right. So it was like, okay, no, you put your plants in the sitting room. Right. So there were these consistent myths about the dangerous houseplant. And so respiration and photosynthesis were seen as a very tangible way of like, oh, plants can do shit. Like plants have agency. Like plants are actively working on our environment and on our air. And so it was this idea of the vegetal miasma, the bad air that would come out of these plants that would suffocate these people in their beds. So it's like the myth, right, of the killer houseplant. And then tying back to colonialism again, a lot of these plants, like if you think about like the Monstera that's wildly popular on Instagram now, and shout out to Cursed Objects, our pod friends.
I thought you were going to shout out your Monstera.
Oh, no. I mean, I have one because I'm a millennial woman. But the Cursed Objects did a whole episode on the variegated Monstera and how it's a cursed object, which is really good. But so if you think about these houseplants, a lot of them were brought back to Britain from these kind of far-flung colonial places and then kept either in glass houses, hot houses, or in the sitting rooms as these like ways of proclaiming your, just as a fashionable thing, right? To have in your house. And so you have this added layer of like the things that could suffocate you in your bed are dangerous in part because they come from somewhere out of Britain. They are colonially dangerous, right? And so it's this idea which was really, which Kristen Hussey in her book Imperial Bodies in London argues brilliantly for, that like the colonial environment, the colonial air and colonial nature, right? Whether it's in that quote unquote other space outside of Britain, or whether it's brought back to London as a place of colonial exchange, it does damage to the British body, right? And so you can see that in illnesses, in injuries, but you can also see it in this myth of the dangerous houseplant. Like the plant comes from somewhere else and is going to therefore damage the British body. But yeah, I love this idea of the vegetal miasma and like the killer houseplant as something that can, with its tendrils, whether you can see them or not, whether they are like the actual vines that are coming out and like enveloping Maud in this photograph, or whether it's the tendrils of carbon dioxide that are going to come in and suffocate you, it has this kind of dangerous agency that I find fascinating. But of course, you know, I'm talking about within the home and you're talking in this photograph about like this co-created space. But I think both are really, really interesting to think about, this kind of positive, negative dance of the human plant entanglement.
And I think firstly, to think of miasma with the smoky, hazy effects of Cameron's lens, I don't think that that's a stretch. You know, I think it contributes to the atmosphere of the photo. And I mean that pun, like, you know, the vibe, but also the hazy, almost tactile qualities. Absolutely. Of air.
But yeah, I totally got that connection with like the soft focus of Cameron's photograph.
And, you know, even though you're talking about miasma and I'm thinking more about tendrils, there is something in both of these things that's important. And it's this dispersal of subjectivity, right? And that we're talking about a radical alterity, a different kind of subjectivity, a non-human kind of subjectivity. So even if you look at the poem, the desire is spread across multiple agents. The whole garden is desiring Maud, right?
Right. And it's like this idea of like the creeping, voracious growth of plants being classed as like queer.
Oh my God. Okay. I had a whole thing. Okay. First of all, queerness in this photograph, absolutely. Queerness and plant agency in this historical period, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's stuff I want to say about colonialism. I think we might have to do another episode on like colonial collecting and stuff, because I think it's just not going to fit in here, but I do want to flag that Cameron moved back to Ceylon or Sri Lanka after taking Maud, where she took a bunch of photographs of people there that are really interesting. But I will say, so it's interesting that you bring that up, because in the decades after Cameron took this photograph, plant horror emerges as a whole sci-fi subgenre. It's obsessed with tendrils. I'm going to show you two illustrations in a second. But I do want to say that there's a lot of fantastic writing that we don't have time to get into about how this genre of plant horror is related to the colonial, and this, you know, part of this idea of like the Gothic, right, is always the return of the repressed.
Yeah.
And the plants are these markers of the of colonial violence for the reasons we've said. They're these specimens brought from all across empire. When you couple that with ideas about plant sentience, it's like, what have these plants seen removed from their native homes? What are they going to then enact on their oppressors? Right. And I want to say Elizabeth Chang has some fantastic writing on this, as does Cheryl Blake Price. So, and that it's a lot just about like colonial anxieties and how they manifest in these things. And one of the things that's really interesting about this genre of plant horror is that in the decades before it really blossoms, you have aestheticist artists, of which Cameron is one, and writers who are likewise exploring some of these themes of plant-human entanglements. And it's not quite horror yet, but as we saw with the source text of Maud, horror seeps into it. It's like staining it. Yeah. I mean, it's not... There is a question of the entanglement, and that gets us to queerness, which I absolutely want to talk about. Mm-hmm. But like queerness for the Victorians, it's right on that edge of like, it's a stain, it's a threat, but it's also more than, bigger than, disrupting.
Non-normative.
Yeah, non-normative in the best and for the Victorians, like worst ways. And sort of like queerness, it has these two valencies of like, for queer people, it is this place of like expression, you know, a way to get beyond certain strictures, also by thinking of other sorts of subjectivities that exist outside of normative understandings thereof. And then from the other end, like deviant, like tendril, like, I mean, plants are queer in, at least in like Holly Furneaux's definition and a lot of definitions, as that which resists heteronormative readings, but also that which has an erotic valence that is non-heteronormative. And Darwin has stuff to say on this as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, carnivorous plants in particular were seen as queer in the 19th century, largely because of their like voracious, othered, non-normative appetites. And so if you think about sexual appetite and like hunger, food appetite, they kind of overlap in the figure of the Venus flytrap, which of course, by the name Venus, is classified as a femme fatale kind of, like a woman who eats, or a mother who eats her young kind of situation.
Yeah.
And there's a really great chapter by Alison Syme that classifies carnivorous plants as the bohemians of the plant world. Like carnivorous plants are the queer figures of botany. And there's this great thing, the Venus flytrap, actually in the late 18th century, so earlier than what we're talking about, but it was for a while called the Tippity Witchet, which is slang for external female genitalia. Yeah. So like in the British imagination, from the 18th century onwards, like it was something that was classed as inherently sexual. And so therefore its appetite was sexual as well. And yeah, there's also a lot with colonialism here and like carnivorous plants seen as something that's out in like the jungles that Britain has to colonize kind of thing. And like, that's also there. But yeah, I totally buy that the Venus flytrap as this like queer femme fatale.
I think this is the thing that's one of the things that's really interesting. I mean, that's, you know, the carnivory thing is sort of more obvious. It's more evident, right? The like femme fatale. And also you have people, Algernon Charles Swinburne, who in Poems and Ballads, you know, is writing about the carnivorous sundew, another insectivorous plant, alongside his descriptions of these like femme fatales. And also he loves a little bit of these sadistic scenes of like, you know, his fantasies of like women inflicting violence on him, or like, you know, this queer also, sexuality is at issue as well. But what's really interesting to me is you don't have to go the carnivorous femme fatale route to see some of these dynamics in Maud, and in fact, to see the sort of positive queer valence. So I feel like we have touched on like the eroticism, or we've touched on the sensuousness of this photograph. I would say it's actually an eroticism, or at least that there's some activation of desire that is going on here. And sort of, I mentioned those like pert passion flower breasts, you know, the arm, the tendril that's like pressing into her, like those.
And it is a love poem also that it's paired with. So, I mean, that just sets the tone for this and the passion flower. Yeah. Passion.
Yeah.
And the keyword.
Well, and you know, an eroticism with perhaps a darker twist, because you mentioned one definition of passion, but passion flowers are actually named after the Passion of Christ.
Aha!
And again,
the bloom of red blood,
Exactly.
Et cetera. Yeah,
and the crucifixion,
crown of thorns.
And
Yeah.
And their shape, their design is said to, like, you know, reference the crown of thorns.
Yeah, that makes sense. See, I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay.
And I think there's this almost like pleasure pain thing that the name passion flower cues us into going on. So, you know, the excerpt starts, "There has fallen a splendid tear." And actually, if you zoom in, you can see this like prick of light on Maud's cheek. That's this tear. And yet there's this sensuousness, desirousness of like the voices of Lily and Rose who want mm-hmm. Maud in the poem. Mm-hmm. And for me, as I said, like it's an explicitly queer desire, by which I both mean non-heteronormative, but also same gendered.
Yeah.
So firstly, there's, you know, the like interspecies eroticism. But then there's also the fact that Cameron handwrites Tennyson's poem. The male narrator is nowhere to be found. Mm-hmm. And this act of handwriting means that Cameron, a woman, is handwriting this love poem through the voices of feminine flowers, Lily and Rose, who are speaking in direct voice, to a woman, Maud.
Yeah.
And like Darwin himself was fascinated with the range of sexualities and fertilization processes of flowers. I'm guessing time-wise, we don't have time to go into it, but I will just say Gillian Beer has this fantastic essay where she talks about the erotic charge generated by Darwin's descriptions of watching his tendrils over hours.
Ooh. Ooh. And like,
yeah, this phenomenological thing that like blooms between them, like Darwin is voyeur. And so—
And I wonder like, how many romance novels have said about, and desire bloomed yes. like in the pit of her stomach. You know, it's a very like unfurling tendrily type thing. Not that I read but also, romance novels.
Of but course. Also, like, tendrils. I mean,
yeah.
Tentacle porn, which is a thing, like, yes, hypothesized. Yeah.
I didn't know if we were going to go there, but here we are. Tentacle porn. It's made it onto the podcast.
They knew, like, Hokusai's prints were known to the Victorians, and that one in particular.
Yeah.
But, you know, so like Darwin acting the voyeur as he watches, and she cites this description where he's watching tendrils, describes them in these really phallic terms and talks about how they find and insert themselves into holes and withdraw, and then insert themselves into another hole and withdraw.
Classic, am I right? Yeah.
And he talks about them like plant marriages, plant offspring. So there's this blurring again of sort of the human or animal and the plant.
Yeah.
And something similar, I think, is happening with the plants expressing their desire for Maud.
Yeah.
And the feminine coding there. And in fact, we don't have time to go into this, but there's a whole genre. There's a great Barbara Barrow article on queer and lesbian desire and poems drawing on a Darwinian poetics. Because, you know, we have this, I think Darwin as we've received him is the Darwin operating in the heterosexist binaries of descent, like male competition.
Yeah.
Like, but as theorists like Sam C have recently uncovered, he has this great essay called Charles Darwin is Queer Theorist. And what he's pointing to is that Darwin's understanding of nature is one that incorporates desire and production in ways that are not necessarily reproductive, that are like non-teleological, non-object driven. It is, you know, looping. It is spiraling.
Yeah.
It's generating, it's falling back on itself. And one of the things that's fascinating about this picture of Maud is there's no fruit. Like, is the plant sterile, or is it that it's two, you know, females of the species, so to speak? And sidebar, I thought we'd get to this, but we didn't. One reviewer called Maud an embodied passion flower in this photograph. So like, is this specifically a queer tango we're witnessing? I think yes.
And because there's no fruit, it's just about the beauty of the flower, which I think is quite powerful.
And
yeah, I love that.
I sort of, as by way of wrapping up, I just want to say like, there's actually a really lot of, there's this queer tone to a lot of Cameron's writing about photography as well. She talks about this girl, Annie, who she wants to photograph. And she said, "I long to try my master hand upon her now that she is 18, you know, but more than that, and this gets back to something you said earlier, Cameron writes about desire and photography in ways that I think are really interesting and remind me of the stuff you were saying about Anna Atkins a little bit. And sort of maybe to close the loop on this plant agency, spiral. Plant desire thing, which is in her writing on photography, a lot of the times there's the sense of the magic of the will like of pure desire. And one of the ways is she talks about how the first time she ever took a photograph, she says, I felt as if the subject had entirely made the photograph.
Mm.
You see that like reversal of sort of agency.
Yeah.
And another time where she sort of says a photograph is like an embodiment of a prayer, which is like directed willing. And then she has this really eroticized description of, she says, I handled my lens, my camera with tender ardor. And so my final provocation to you is, did the plant make this photo? Like, does the plant, is the plant the subject who in this version desires the photo? Because Maud is summoned into the garden, which doesn't happen in Tennyson's poem. Like she's Maud comes into the garden for an instant, but her brother's like hot on her heels.
Ah. Oh, and then, and so, you know, the fact, as you kind of alluded to at the beginning, the fact that Cameron chose that segment of the poem to be illustrated by this image absolutely leads you to believe that it is the lily and the rose and the passion flower itself who are desiring Maud, desiring their own image, like desiring this kind of blooming, this blossoming, and this, this passion, this like love.
Okay, so I wanted to sort of wrap up my thoughts about it as well, although I'm still curious to hear yours. Like, there is a lot of discussion, the poem about Maud is potentially dead. And we talked about how in this, you know, as you said, the position on her, like, is she in a grave?
Right.
But there's a passage in right before this part of the poem where Tennyson says, and the soul of the rose went into my blood. And I think there's this question here, which is like, is the plant one of these horror subjects, like in H.G. Wells's books about orchids drawing the blood from their victims? Or is there something more mutual going on? Is it lending her energy, lending her agency? Are we looking at an ecological process almost like, I mean, if you think about like decay, it's like she is fed on the fruits of her environment and then through death seeps back in to feed it through like her rotting fluids. Also this loop.
A closed spiral, as it were.
Yeah.
But I love that, you know, coming back to the photograph at the end of this conversation, and we've been talking about plant-human entanglements, both positive and negative in this era. And now that I'm looking at this photograph again, I'm like, this is the visual embodiment of a plant-human entanglement. Like, I wasn't thinking about that at the beginning, but this is entangled. Like, she is entangled. And I really appreciate that, like, clear connection.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, Ernst Haeckel, sort of building on Darwin, coins the term ecology in the 1860s, shortly before this photograph is taken. And it's this idea of not seeing nature as this monolith that exists sort of in separate, like, I don't know, this big external, almost like this theological understanding of nature, but as something that is fundamentally about a set of relations and interrelations and dependencies and what Timothy Morton, I think, calls the mesh, you know?
Right.
I have to say this, in one of the chapters in our book, Kate Flint talks about an ecological gaze and like the close looking that this sort of photograph, but a lot of idylls require from you, and how you almost end up slowing down to like plant time, you know? Like, how long must she have stood there for that like tendril to?
Yeah. And that goes back to the Darwin, like watching methodically these tendrils expand and go in and come out and spiral around. Yeah.
And Cameron's expanded photograph, like camera times as well, that we're actually seeing an unfolding of time.
Absolutely. But no, I think the idea of like plant time and unfurling tendrils is a really evocative image to keep in mind, like while looking at this piece and while talking about the Victorian plant human entanglements that we've been discussing.
Can I just show you the plant tendril photos I kept trying to send you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I sent you one more picture of tentacles. This one is from H.G. Wells' sci-fi book, The Strange Orchid.
I was going to look into this and then I was like, fuck it, I can't. Ah! Oh my gosh.
It's sucking the
blood. I love that.
I know.
I love the strange orchid. Tendrils out the wazoo, man. Very The Last
of
Us.
So many tendrils. We didn't even get to Donna Haraway and like tentacular thinking.
We don't.
But I know. But just everyone go look up Donna Haraway on tentacular thinking and eflux.